If you turn to the book of Acts, Acts chapter 9, and my subject for tonight, the Apostle Paul's methodology and motivation in terms of Christian ministry. In this book of Acts, Paul's traveling companion, Luke, records five visits that the Apostle Paul makes to the city of Jerusalem after his conversion. The first visit that he makes to Jerusalem post-conversion is in this chapter, Acts chapter 9. And I'd like to pick up the reading, Acts chapter 9. If you'll notice it here in verse 26. Acts chapter 9, verse 26. We're talking about the visits that Paul made to the city of Jerusalem after he was converted. And this is the first time he visits Jerusalem post-conversion. It is in Acts chapter 9, and it's verse 26. And when Saul was come to Jerusalem, he tried to join himself to the disciples. So this is the first visit to Jerusalem post-conversion. In Acts chapter 11, we have his second visit. It is recorded in verse 29 and 30. Acts chapter 11, verse 29. This is the second visit to Jerusalem. Then the disciples, this is up in Antioch, Syria. Then the disciples, every man according to his ability, determined to send relief unto the brethren which dwelt in Judea, which also they did, and sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. When you come to chapter 12, verse 25, we read, and Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had fulfilled their ministry. So that was visit number two, post-conversion. When you come to Acts chapter 15, this is the third visit to Jerusalem. It was the Jerusalem Council that we've talked about over the last couple of weeks. When you come to Acts chapter 15, you read verse 4. And when they were come to Jerusalem, they were received by the church and the apostles and the elders. That is visit number 3. The fourth visit is recorded in Acts chapter 18. We have it in verse 22. And when he had landed, this is Paul, when he had landed at Caesarea on the coast and gone up and saluted the church, that was in Jerusalem, he went down to Antioch. That was visit number 4. And finally, the fifth visit is the one that is recorded in Acts chapter 21. This is the final and last visit to the city of Jerusalem after he was converted. And I'd like to pick it up in chapter 21 and verse 17. So follow along as I read it. Chapter 21, verse 17, the last visit to Jerusalem, which almost cost him his life, as you recall. Verse 17. And when we were come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. So the writer of the book was with Paul. Luke was with him. And the day following, Paul went in with us unto James, and all the elders were present. And when he had greeted them, he declared particularly what things God had done among the Gentiles by his ministry. And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord and said unto him, thou seest, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are who believe, and they're all zealots of the law. And they're informed of thee that thou teachest all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying they ought not to circumcise their children, neither to walk after the customs. What is it therefore? The multitude will certainly come together, for they will hear that thou art come. Do therefore this that we say to thee. Now this was really the counsel given by the leadership of the Mother Church in Jerusalem. So this was the recommendation. Verse 23. We have four men who have taken a vow upon them, which again, you recall, Nazarite vow, in accordance with Numbers chapter 6. Them take and purify yourself with them. Be ceremonially cleansed and be in charges with them. Assume the responsibility, the financial responsibility of these four men, that they may shave their heads and all may know that those things whereof they were informed concerning thee are nothing, but that thou thyself also walks orderly and keepest the law. As concerning the Gentiles who believe, we've written and concluded that they observe no such thing except only that they keep themselves from things offered to idols and from blood and from strangled and from fornication, which of course we read in Acts chapter 15. Then Paul took the men and the next day purified himself with them, entered into the temple to signify the completion of the days of purification until that an offering should be offered for each one of them. They're in the temple. They were going to offer sacrifices, and Paul was going to pay the expenses of it. Now, when you read this again, I do not believe that Paul was wrong at all. He wasn't wrong because he had previously taken a Nazarite vow himself when he was in the city of Corinth, as we read about in Acts chapter 18, verse 18. So if Paul participated in a Nazarite vow himself prior to this, then how could it have been wrong for him to be engaged in this, as you read it in Acts chapter 21? So I don't think he was wrong at all. When he stood before Felix in Acts chapter 24 and referred back to what happened here, he was unashamed about what he had done. So how do you explain that in Acts chapter 24 when he talks about what happened in 21 and there's no shame, no guilt at all about what had happened? Furthermore, when I read his words in Acts chapter 23, he asserts he never violated his conscience. And that was subsequent to this event. So how does one explain that if one says that he's wrong here in Acts chapter 21, in terms of this Nazarite vow, paying the expenses, being ceremonially cleansed, being in the temple when they're offering the sacrifices? But furthermore, when you read this, he wasn't denied the finished work of Jesus Christ. He'd already written a number of letters. He'd already written, for example, Galatians and 2 Thessalonians and 1 and 2 Corinthians and Romans. So there's no way that he would have denied the finished work of Jesus Christ. That would have been incomprehensible when you consider those particular letters that he's already written. When you read this, it ought to be noted also that the reason why he made this trip to Jerusalem was to unify the Jews and the Gentiles. And that's what he was attempting to do on the basis of the recommendation of the leadership of the church in Jerusalem led by James himself. So when you read this, it's very difficult to say that Paul was wrong, even though some would say that he was wrong. I do not believe that he was wrong at all. I believe that he was following a principle that he establishes in 1 Corinthians that we have read. And the principle, of course, would be that if there's any way that he can accommodate himself to a Jew or even to someone under the law in order to win that person over, to gain that person, then he was willing to do it. And this is an example of that methodology that we read about in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Now that brings us back to that particular text. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Verses 19 through 23 that we've read on a number of occasions in this particular study. So I'd like to come full circle, and I'd like to come back to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Now, I want you to notice the words as I read them. This is verses 19 through 23. And I think Acts 21 is a beautiful illustration of this principle. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all, that I might win the more. To the Jews, I became as a Jew, that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. And I do all things for the sake of the gospel, that I may become a fellow partaker of it. Now, when we come to this particular text, if we really want to understand these particular verses, we have to place them within the context of Paul's argument. So if I really want to understand verses 19 through 23, what is the context within which these verses are found? Now, I want us to go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And I want you to notice this verse, the opening verse of 1 Corinthians 7, verse 1. And Paul writes this. Now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, and then he moves into his response. Now on the basis of chapter 7 and verse 1, we know that the Corinthians raised a number of issues to Paul. We know that they raised a number of questions by way of writing, and they wanted him to answer these questions. Now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, and then he begins to respond to these questions. And when you pick it up here in chapter 7, verse 1, you read a little phrase all the way through chapter 16 that tells me he's now responding to another question. And the little phrase is the phrase found here in chapter 7, verse 1, now concerning. In Greek, it's peridet. So I can pick it up, this peridet, from chapter 7, verse 1, and I can follow it all the way to the end of chapter 16. And every time I have peridet, he is picking up this question and he's responding to it. So I read it here in chapter 7, verse 1. I read it in chapter 7, verse 25. Now concerning. I read it in chapter 8, verse 1. Now concerning. I read it in chapter 12 and verse 1. Now concerning. I read it in chapter 16, verse 1. Now concerning. And for a final time, I read it in chapter 16, verse 12. Now concerning. So it all finds its source in chapter 7, verse 1. Now concerning the things that you wrote unto me, and then he responds to these questions. He does in chapter 7, he does in chapter 8, he does in chapter 12, he does in chapter 16. And you can follow that little peridet, peridet, peridet. Now we come back to the one that is mentioned in chapter 8. And when you come to chapter 8 and verse 1, you have that little phrase, now concerning. And when we read it, we know that this was a question that they had raised, and it encompasses the material of chapters 8, 9, and 10. So when we deal with this question that they raised to Paul, and they want him to respond to it, we recognize we're not going to stop with chapter 8 or chapter 9. We're going to stop at the end of chapter 10, really the beginning of chapter 11, verse 1. So he begins in chapter 8, verse 1, and he argues it all the way to chapter 11 in verse 1. It's the reason why when you pick it up in chapter 12, now concerning, and he's talking about gifts, he deals with chapter 12, chapter 13, chapter 14. So you're not really dealing with all of it until you deal with it as a unit, 12 to 14, 8 through 10. So now we come to the question that is raised, and the verses of chapter 9 fall within this framework, chapters 8, 9, and 10, and this is the question that he's responding to. Now, when you think about the question, we could say it like this. Paul, is it acceptable for a Christian to buy and eat meat that is taken from an animal that had been offered in sacrifice to an idol? Can we purchase that meat and actually eat it, Paul? That's the question. Or we could say, Paul, is it acceptable for us to eat meat if someone invites us into their home and they serve us meat? Is it acceptable for us to simply eat the meat? That's the question. Or we could say it like this. Paul, is it acceptable to attend a pagan sacrifice and to enjoy the meat of the celebration that would be observed within the temple precincts? Can we do that, Paul? Is that acceptable? Because remember, great controversy, evidently, it was a major issue in the Corinthian assembly. There was great controversy over it. Can we buy and eat this meat? Can we eat this meat if it's served to us in a private home? Can we attend one of these sacrifices, these pagan sacrifices, and the meat is there in the temple precinct and it's served? Can we eat that? Can we be there and eat that, Paul? Now, those are the questions. Now, listen to the way one writer puts it. The buying of butcher meat in pagan cities such as Corinth and Rome presented some Christians with a conscientious problem. Much of the flesh exposed for sale in the market came from animals which had originally been sacrificed to a pagan deity. The pagan deity received his token portion. The rest of the flesh might be sold by the temple authorities to the retail merchants, and many pagan purchasers might be willing to pay a little more for their meat because it had been consecrated to some deity. Among the Christians, there were some with a robust conscience who knew that the meat was neither better nor worse for its association with the pagan deity and were quite happy to eat it. Others were not so happy about it and felt that somehow the meat had become infected by its idolatrous association. So can you buy it? Can you eat it? If you serve that meat, can you simply eat what he has served to you? Can you go into the temple precincts and all of this is taking place? Can you be there? Can you eat it? And evidently there was a lot of controversy about it. Now, it's not just here in 1 Corinthians chapters 8, 9, and 10. It's also in Romans chapters 14 and 15. If he writes 1 Corinthians, where does he write 1 Corinthians from? City of Ephesus. If he writes the letter to the Romans, where was he when he penned the letter to the Romans? He was in Corinth. So when you read this in 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10, the parallel is in Romans 14 and 15. In Romans 14 and 15, it's expanded in terms of diet, in terms of holy days. So it's expanded in terms of what was happening in Rome, but the same controversy existed. So what I read in 1 Corinthians 8 through 10 is what I read in Romans chapters 14 and 15. And I've got to dovetail those two passages, understanding what those two passages are teaching me. Now, there is something else that needs to be said, and that is, when we read these passages, whether it be Romans 14 and 15 or 1 Corinthians 8 through 10, we're talking about morally indifferent matters. We're talking about things that are not wrong in and of themselves. We're talking about neutral things. Now, this is very important to understand. So when I'm reading these chapters, Romans 14, 15, 1 Corinthians 8 through 10, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with what we're talking about. It's morally neutral. And yet there was disagreement among Christians about what ought to take place. Diet, days, meat offered to idols. I mean, there was controversy about it. And Christians disagreed with one another whether or not a Christian should be involved in this practice. And godly, godly people disagreed with one another. Now, when I read this, obviously we're not having the same kind of problems today. But you have good and godly Christians that disagree over particular matters that are not intrinsically wrong. There's nothing wrong with what we're talking about. And yet there is controversy over whether or not one should do it. Now, we all know what we're talking about. Now, let me read the words of Richard Sumi, who gives an illustration from his own life. And he says it like this. In the early days of one of my pastorates, I found my lot cast among a group of believers with very strong convictions about certain peripheral matters, including eating in a public restaurant on Sunday. Before coming to that assembly, this matter had not been a problem with me. Indeed, I had never even considered it a problem. One Sunday evening, on my way to the service, I stopped off at the hospital to visit several patients and then stopped in at a diner for a quick snack. It happened that the place was filled with a cacophony of music, which hardly prepared me for the message. During the course of my sermon, I mentioned the incident in passing, little realizing that my own congregation, as well as the radio audience in that metropolitan area, had other thoughts about such a thing. When I returned home that night after the service, I was scarcely in the house before the telephone rang, and a rough voice at the other end said, "Brother, I want to ask you something. If you had died in that diner tonight, where would you have gone?" Without hesitation, I replied, "Why, to heaven, my friend. Nothing of it. You would have gone straight to hell." Now, obviously, there were some strong sentiments about whether or not you should eat in a particular place on a Sunday. So even though we're not talking about kosher eating or particular holy days or food offered in sacrifice to some animal, to some deity, some animal, some meat that is offered to some idol. Since we're not talking about that, there's still issues where there's a lot of heat, not a whole lot of light, but a lot of heat in terms of Christians. It can involve dress. It can involve drink. It can involve standards of living. It can involve various forms of entertainment. I mean, there are various things where people have strong, strong feelings. So what I read in Romans 14 and 15 and what I read about in 1 Corinthians 8 through 10 certainly is relevant to all of us. Not the same specific issues, but nevertheless, there are issues the good and godly Christians disagree about. So we come to these chapters, 8, 9, and 10, and the verses that I'm talking about in chapter 9 fall within this framework. And when we come to chapter 8 underscores the problem. Meat offered to idols. Can you buy this meat? Can you eat this kind of meat? The strong believer said, yes.
We can buy it, we can eat it. An idol is a non-entity. The meat is not affected at all. It's not contaminated at all because an idol doesn't exist. So obviously you have the freedom, you have the liberty to buy it and to eat it. That would be the strong believer. But the weak believer did not believe that should happen. The weak believer did not believe that that meat should be bought, much less that meat eaten. And there would have been very strong feelings. Now you know what Romans 14 says? The strong person was very condescending and very haughty and looked down upon this weak brother. And you know what the problem with the weak one was? He was very critical and very judgmental of the one that was strong. So one looked down upon and the other one judged and was critical of. Those are the attitudes that we read about in Romans chapter 14 concerning the weak and the strong. Paul places himself in the category of the strong. But he talks about the weak and the strong in Romans 14 and 15 and 1 Corinthians 8 through 10. In this text, the strong believes they can do whatever in terms of meat because it doesn't matter. Nothing's wrong with the meat. If it's cheaper, buy it. If you serve the meat, eat it. And it doesn't matter if you're in the temple precinct or not, because idols are not entities, they don't exist. Whereas a weak person doesn't feel that way at all. Now I want you to notice what 1 Corinthians chapter 8 has to say. Now let me just read this, and I want you to just follow along at the very beginning of this chapter, 1 Corinthians chapter 8, and notice what we read. Now concerning things offered unto idols, verse 1, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And if any man think that he knows anything, he knows nothing yet as he ought to know. But if any man loves God, the same is known of him. As concerning therefore the eating of those things that are offered in sacrifice unto idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world. And there is none other God but one. For though there be that are called gods, whether in heaven or in earth, as there be gods many and lords many, but to us there is but one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we in him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and we by him. Now here's the verse. Howbeit there is not in every man that knowledge, for some with conscience of the idol unto this hour eat it as a thing offered unto an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. Now let me just pause here. We're talking about conscience. If you talk about conscience, and the word conscience is used 32 times in the New Testament. If we talk about conscience, and Paul is the one who basically uses the word conscience. John will use the word heart if our heart condemns us. And to John, 1 John 3, heart would be Paul's conscience. And John is using it the way that it's used in the Old Testament. But Paul is the one who uses the word conscience. Now, if you think of the word conscience, I mean, what does the word mean? Science means knowledge. Con means with. So if you think of conscience, you have a knowledge with. You know with. Now, you oftentimes hear someone say, well, let your conscience be your guide. But that is not right. Let your conscience be your guide. Your conscience may be faulty. Your conscience may be completely wrong. The question would be, what is the standard by which your conscience is governed? What is the standard? That's the key. So an individual might have been entrenched in some type of thinking, and that individual thinks this is wrong on the basis of what he was taught. And if he's engaged in that, he feels guilty about it. We can use all kinds of illustrations. Take a girl. You're a small girl, and the mother pounds into the little girl's mind that it's wrong to wear pants. And that is pounded into her
head as a little girl and as she's growing up. Now, if she really feels that way and thinks that way, and she puts on a pair of pants, she would be prone to feel guilty. She would be prone to feel guilty because she would think that this wasn't right. It wasn't right because this is the standard by which her mother taught her, even though the standard is completely wrong. This is the way she was taught, and her conscience, according to that standard, made her feel psychologically bad about it, and she felt guilty about it. So we recognize the standard's faulty. Her mother was completely wrong to teach her this, but nevertheless she embraced it, she assimilated it, and now she struggles with it. But you can take that principle and apply it across the board in terms of anything that we're talking about that is non-moral. And then an individual, because he thinks this particular way, he feels that this practice is not right, whatever it might be. And we're talking about something that is non-moral. So, when you talk about conscience, the key is the standard. The standard that governs the conscience and the conscience is sensitive to. That's what we're talking about. Now, if you read verse 7, aren't we talking about someone who has a weak conscience? Now, if you talk about someone with a weak conscience, what does that mean? It means that it's an overly sensitive conscience. It's an overly scrupulous conscience. That's what we're talking about. Now look at the verse again in verse 7. Howbeit there is not in every man that knowledge, for some with conscience of the idol unto this hour eat it as a thing offered unto an idol. And their conscience being weak is defiled. And the word defiled means it is stained, it is contaminated. It feels guilty. It feels like it's defiled by sin. It spiritually and psychologically affects the person. That's what we're talking about. So here's an individual who has a lot of baggage. Here's an individual who is a pagan, Corinthian. Would go to the temple, sacrifice to this deity, this idol, would give the meat, have a portion of it, eat it, all associated with the idol and this deity. And now the person's saved. And this practice that he was engaged in for all of these years still causes him a lot of problems. Because he has all of these associations, these past associations with these practices. And he thinks about all the things he used to do in the temple. And so now he's saved. And if he were to do that, in his own mind, he would be back doing the things he used to do as a pagan. And so now he's divorced himself from that, and he thinks that's wrong. And he thinks that should be in the past, and it shouldn't be done at all. Because he associates this meat with his practices, his religious practices that he used to do as an unsaved pagan. So I'm reading this. I mean, this is the problem. He has a weak conscience. He believes that meat associated with idols is contaminated. And if he were engaged in eating that meat, he would feel guilty about it. That's what we read. Now look at Paul. Look at what Paul says. Verse 8. But meat commends us not to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, neither if we eat not are we the worse. You see what he's saying? There's nothing wrong with the meat. The meat is not a contaminant. It doesn't matter if you eat it or you don't eat it. It doesn't matter. There's nothing wrong with the meat. And no one is better or worse for eating it. That's what it says, correct? But follow it. Verse 9. But watch out, lest by any means this right of yours becomes a stumbling block to them who are weak. For if any man see thee, who have knowledge, sit at meat in the idol's temple, shall not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things which are offered to idols? And through your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died? What does he mean by perish? Perish means to be ruined. I mean to be affected in a very detrimental way. It doesn't mean to lose your being. It means to lose your well-being. So this verse is going to be ruined. And then he asks the question in verse 11, whom Christ died? And then we read verse 12. For when you sin so against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. And I would say that's pretty strong language from Paul. So here's someone who is weak. He lacks biblical knowledge. He's weak in his conscience. And because he's weak in his conscience, he can be influenced to act contrary to the way he believes is right. So if you read the statement, and we talk about a strong Christian versus a weak Christian, the strong Christian is in the temple, and he's eating the meat. And he doesn't think there's anything wrong with this at all, because he thinks that the idol, of course, is a non-entity. This God is a non-entity. It doesn't exist. Doesn't matter at all. But here you have a weak person, and he thinks that's wrong. But what does he say in verse 10? What does he say about the weak person in verse 10? The weak person sees the strong person doing this. And because the strong person is doing it, the weak person is prompted to do it. He actually does it. He carries it out. All the while, thinking that he's wrong. And he feels terrible about it. He feels guilty about it. But he does it. He actually does it. He does what this other person does. The other person has the freedom to do it. This person doesn't have the freedom or liberty to do it, because he thinks it's wrong. But based on the example of this other believer, he does it and feels guilty. Isn't that what we're talking about? So we read it here. Look at it. Verse 10. If any man see thee who has knowledge sit at meat in the idol's temple, shall not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things which are offered to idols? And through your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died? And when you sin so against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. So I would say this is pretty strong. Now, he's not talking about someone who's sitting on the sidelines throwing rocks at you. He's not talking about some Pharisee who's over here, who is a complete bigot, spiritual bigot, who thinks what you're doing is wrong and is basically blasting you for it. He's not talking about that. He's not talking about a Pharisee. He's not talking about that person. He's talking about a person who sees you do something and he actually does it. And because he does it, he feels guilty about it, because he doesn't have the freedom to do it. Because when he does it, in his mind, or all the things that he used to think about when he was lost, and all of that comes back, and he's reliving all of the things that he used to do as an unsaved pagan. And all of those associations and all those memories connected with these events, that's what he's thinking about, and he feels guilty about it. So a strong person has the freedom to do it. A weak person doesn't have the freedom to do it, but he does it because he sees the strong person do it. And he's psychologically and spiritually affected negatively. Now, I want you to notice what Paul says, because Paul classifies himself as a strong person in Romans 14 and 15. He places himself among the strong. So I want you to notice what he says in verse 13. Wherefore, if food causes my brother to stumble, I will by no means ever eat flesh sacrificed to idols forever, lest I cause my brother to stumble. I'm not going to do it. If this is going to cause the weak person problems, I'm not going to do it. And he says it the strongest way he can say it. I will by no means ever eat, forever. And he uses the word, which is flesh, that is offered in sacrifice to an idol, lest I cause my brother to stumble. And the word that he uses is scandalizo. If I scandalize this person, I'm not going to do it. If this causes this person problems, I'm not going to do it. So that's what he says. Now listen to the words of F.F. Bruce. If a Christian was considering whether or not to eat this or that kind of food, the decision should depend upon the effect which the taking or leaving it would have on the conscience of a fellow Christian. If a Christian was considering whether or not to eat this or that kind of food, the decision should depend on the effect which the taking or leaving it would have on the conscience of a fellow Christian. You know what he says in Romans chapter 14? Be fully persuaded in your own mind. Be absolutely convinced in your own mind concerning whatever practice you pursue. And you know what he also says in Romans 14? If you doubt it, and there's any kind of doubt about it, don't do it. Because if you do it, and you doubt why you're doing it, it is sin. That's what he says in Romans 14. You'll be fully persuaded in your own mind in terms of the practice. You're absolutely convinced there's nothing wrong with this. But if you're not fully convinced, and there is some doubt, don't do it. Doesn't that really help us an awful lot? I mean, you talk to someone and they wonder whether or not they should do this or that. The very fact that they wonder whether or not they should do this or that, they shouldn't do it. Romans 14 says they should not do it. If you doubt it, don't do it. Because if you do it, you are sinning. That's what Romans 14 says. So here's a weak person. He's prompted to do something that doesn't have the liberty to do. Does it because he sees the example of the strong. And as a result, he's affected negatively by the behavior of the strong. That's what we're reading. So here's the principle. Here's the principle of chapter 8. Knowledge brings freedom. Knowledge brings freedom. But love always limits freedom. Knowledge brings freedom. But love always limits freedom. Why? Because love is greater than knowledge. Love is greater than knowledge. Knowledge brings freedom. But love always limits freedom because love is greater than knowledge. Isn't that chapter 8, verse 1? Now concerning the things offered to the idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Or you come to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, and you read verse 2. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, and I have not love, even though I have all knowledge, if I have not love, I'm nothing. So knowledge brings freedom. But love always limits freedom because love is greater than knowledge. Now, when you come to this, if there are words that are emphasized, it certainly would be the word freedom and the word rights. Those are buzzwords in these chapters 8, 9, and 10. Freedom and rights. I have my freedom, I have liberty, and I have my rights. That's absolutely emphasized. If I think of freedom, how about this in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 1. Look at your questions. And then in the midst of the questions, there's this one. Am I not an apostle? Question 1. Am I not free? Am I not free? Question 2. Have I not seen Jesus Christ our Lord? Question 3. Are not ye my work in the Lord? Question 4. Now, when you read those questions, all four of them demand what kind of answer? Yes. And you can ask a question in Greek, and if you use the negative ooh, it means yes. If you use the negative may, it means no. So the way a question is asked will determine whether or not the answer is yes or no. The way he asked these four questions, it demands a yes response to all four of them, grammatically. Am I not an apostle? Yes, I am. Am I not free? Yes, I am. Have I not seen Jesus Christ our Lord? Yes, I have. Are not ye my work in the Lord? Yes, you are. But he talks about being free. Then look at chapter 9, look at verse 19. For though I be free from all men, I'm free. So he certainly talks about freedom. But he also emphasizes the concept of rights. Now let me just point out the word. Chapter 8, verse 9. But take heed lest by any means this, it's not liberty, it's power or right. But take heed lest by any means this right of yours, becomes a stumbling block to them that are weak. And the word that is used in chapter 8, verse 9 is repeated in chapter 9, verse 4. Have we not power? Have we not the right? Verse 5. Have we not the right? Verse 6, or I only and Barnabas, have we not the right? Or if I come down to verse 12, if others be partakers of this right over you, are not we rather? Nevertheless, we have not used this right. And then finally, verse 18, what is my reward then verily that when I preach the gospel, I may make the gospel of Christ without charge, that I've used not my right in the gospel? So he's emphasizing the whole concept of freedom, this whole concept of rights. So what's his point in chapter 9? Here's his point. I have the right, as an apostle, to be financially supported by the church. I have that right. I have the right that you financially support me. And he brought buttresses, all kinds of arguments to buttress this point. I have the right. You ought to support me financially. But even though I have the right, I'm not going to exercise the right. I'm going to forego the right, even though I have it. I'm not going to exercise, I'm not going to use the right for a higher purpose. Now that's the argument in chapter 9. And he argues it in a lot of different ways. Now look at the way he writes, chapter 9, verse 4. Have we not the right to eat and to drink? Yes, we do. Have we not the right to lead about a sister or wife as well as other apostles and the brothers of the Lord at Cephas? Yes. Or I only am Barnabas. Have we not the right to forbear working? Then I come down to verse 12. If others be partakers of this right over you, are not we rather? Nevertheless, we have not used this right, but permit all things lest we should hinder the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that they who minister about holy things live of the things of the temple, and they who wait at the altar are partakers with the altar? Even so has the Lord ordained that they which preach the gospel should live of the gospel. But I've not used any of these things, neither have I written these things, that it should be so done unto me, for it were better for me to die than that any man should make my glory in void. You see it? I have the right to be financially supported by you Corinthians. But I'm going to forgo the right. I haven't exercised, I haven't used the right. And he says in verse 15, I'm not writing these things in order for you to support me. I'm not writing these things in order to convey some sort of message that you ought to be financially supporting me. That's not the reason why I'm doing this. I mean, you see his point? Verse 15, but I've used none of these things, neither have I written these things, that it should be so done unto me, for it were better for me to die than that any man should make my glory in void. And the reason why he did this, if you read 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians, is because he was being viciously attacked. And individuals, his critics, his enemies, were saying, he's in it for the money. He's doing it for the money. And in order to take away the ammunition that they were using against him, he didn't exercise the right to be financially supported by the Corinthians. That's what was happening. Let me just read it. Listen to what he says in his second letter. Listen to 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 8. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 8. I robbed other churches, taking wages of them to do you service. And when I was present with you and I wanted, I was chargeable to no man. For that which was lacking to me, the brethren which came from Macedonia supplied. But in all things, I have kept myself from being burdensome unto you, and so will I keep myself. As the truth of Christ is in me, no man will stop me of this boasting in the regions of Achaia. Why? Because I love you not, God knows, but here it is. What I do, that I will do, that I may cut off occasion from them who desire occasion, that wherein they boast, they may be found even as we. So you come to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. He talks about freedom. He talks about liberty. He talks about rights. He certainly had this right, but he didn't use them. He didn't use it. He didn't exercise it for a greater reason. Now, if that's true, doesn't that take some self-control and some self-discipline? I mean, I have the freedom and I have the right to do this particular thing, but I recognize for a greater good, I'm going to forgo the right. Doesn't that exercise self? Doesn't that mean self-control? Doesn't that mean I have to discipline myself in order to do that? That's why he ends chapter 9 the way he does in verses 24 through 27 when he talks about an athlete. And an athlete is willing to do all of this in order to gain this prize. He's talking about what an athlete would do, what an individual would be willing to do for a greater purpose. Now, if you're reading this in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and he talks about a runner and he talks about a wrestler and he talks about a boxer, you know what he's talking about? He's talking about the Isthmian Games. The Isthmian Games that were held every 2 years outside the city of Corinth. He's talking about the Isthmian Games. There were the Olympian Games, there were the Pythian Games, there were the Nemean Games, and there were the Isthmian Games. There were four different games. But this, no question, would be the Isthmian Games, because those in Corinth would know all about the Isthmian Games. And they would know what an athlete would do. Trained for 10 months, did all of these things. And he talks about, when you read it, verses 24 through 27, that an athlete exercises self-control for a 10-month period of time in order to win this prize. But you're talking about self-control, you're talking about discipline, you're talking about all of that. So when Paul says, I have the right, but I'm not going to exercise it, he acknowledges it takes discipline to do this. So when you come to chapter 10, what's his point in chapter 10? He's talking about the Corinthians. Well, what is he talking about the Corinthians? The Corinthians would be talking about their privileges. The Corinthians would be talking about all of their blessings and all the things that they were able to do. So you know what Paul does? He talks about the privileges that Israel experienced. He goes back to Israel. And when you read chapter 10, verses 1 through 4, you know what he emphasizes? The word all. You have it over and over again.
verses 1 through 4. Then when you come to verse 5, but with many of them, most of them, God was not well pleased. They all died out in the wilderness, with the exception of two, Joshua and Caleb. But everybody else died. So yes, they had incredible privileges. But look at what happened to them. And then he talks about, and he picks out five particular vices that they committed. Let me just read them. Verse 6. Now these things were our examples to the intent we should not desire after evil things as they also desired. That's Numbers 11. Neither be idolaters, as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. That's Exodus 32. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed and fell in one day 23,000. That's Numbers 25. Neither let us test Christ, as some of them also tested and were destroyed by serpents. That's Numbers 21. Neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed by the destroyer. That's Numbers 14 and Numbers 16. So what were the sins? Lusting after things that were not appropriate, idolatry, fornication, testing, murmuring. But that wasn't just true of ancient Israel, it was true of the Corinthians also. They were desiring things that were not really right. They were engaged in idolatry. They were engaged in fornication. They were testing Christ. They were murmuring over various things. So you read it here, verse 11. Now all these things happened unto them for examples, and they're written for our warning upon whom the ends of the world are come. Then we read it, wherefore let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. You see it? The Corinthians were talking about their freedom, their privileges, that they could do this and it wouldn't bother them at all. And Paul steps back and says, look at ancient Israel. Look at their privileges, but look at what happened to them. And look at their vices. And you better watch yourself, because if you think you can stand, you're on the verge of falling. They fell, and so can you. Isn't that what he's saying? And all of this is written to encourage us and to warn us, because we have all of these examples. And if it happened to them, it can certainly happen to us. So when you come to these questions that are raised, he begins to answer these questions in verses 14 and following of chapter 10. What about this meat that is eaten in a pagan temple? What about that meat? He answers it in verses 14 through 22. You know what he says? Verse 14. Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry. Don't be involved in that temple at all. Get out of there. Run. And if you're involved in those kinds of sacrifices, don't you know that they're sacrificing to demons? We recognize and understand that idols are non-entities. These deities don't exist. But there is all kinds of satanic activity being done in that temple. Look at his words. Verse 20. I say that the things that the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. I would not that you should have fellowship with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot be partakers of the Lord's table and the table of demons. So what he says, don't be in the temple precinct. Don't be engaged when they're involved in all of this idolatry. Flee from idolatry. Get away from there. He doesn't answer it until he answers it here. Because you would think when you read chapter 8, it's all right to go into the idol's temple. Oh no. It wasn't right. He says in chapter 10, that's not a good place to be. Now look at what he says. Verse 23. All things are lawful for me, but all things are not expedient. All things are lawful for me, but all things do not edify. Now, isn't that an interesting statement? All things are lawful for me. Don't you think that's probably what the Corinthians were saying? All things are lawful for me. All things are permitted to me. I have the freedom. I have the liberty to do whatever, Paul.
He took their own words. All things are lawful for me. That's what they were saying to him. And he says, all things may be lawful, but not all things are helpful, and not all things are edifying. All things are lawful for me, but all things are not expedient. They're not helpful. They're not beneficial. All things are lawful for me, but all things do not edify. They don't build up. So you can talk about freedom, but is it a good practice? Is it a helpful practice? Is it an advantageous practice? Is it something that will build up and edify another person? Hold your place here. Go back to chapter 6. Look at the principle, verse 12. All things are lawful unto me, but all things are not expedient. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any. Chapter 6, verse 12. So when you talk about all things, and the Corinthians were saying, all things are lawful, all things are permitted, we have the freedom, the liberty to do whatever, Paul says, is it helpful? Does it build up? Does it cause you to be reduced to slavery so that you have to do this? And then I read chapter 10, verse 24. Let no man seek his own, but every man another's well-being. Didn't that tell you everything? Is this a helpful practice? Is this a practice that would reduce me to bondage or slavery? Is this a practice that builds someone else up? Is this something where I'm not thinking of myself? I'm thinking of the well-being of the other person. That no man seek his own, but each man another's well-being. I mean, doesn't that really help us in the sense of understanding in terms of practices? You say, well, what about meat that is sold in the marketplace? And what about you're invited to someone's home and this is offered to you? Should you eat it? Well, he answers those questions. I'm going to come back. I'll deal with those questions, and I'm coming back to chapter 9, verses 19 through 23, within the context of all of these controversial matters over non-essential things. Nothing wrong with the meat, even though there was differences of opinion about it. We do not meet next week. I'm going to be going next week, so next Thursday we will not meet. Lord willing, we'll pick it back up the next week. I'll deal with this, and I'll end with principles drawn from Romans 14, 15, and 1 Corinthians 8 through 10. And then I'm going to deal with that whole perspective on Paul. I'll do a crash course on the perspective of Paul, the new perspective on Paul, which we have to understand something about. And then I'm in Hebrews. I'll lead us in prayer. Our gracious Heavenly Father, we thank Thee for the Scriptures, principles that help us to navigate in very tumultuous terrain at times. We think of disagreements among Christians, and we pray that we would understand principles that we can apply that would help us to answer various questions that are raised within our own minds or that are raised to us by other people. So guide us, Lord, in our thinking, even as we think of this whole subject of weak Christians versus strong Christians. For I pray it in Jesus' name, amen.